In the late 80s and early 90s, Stephon Morant and his best friend Scott Lewis were dealing drugs for local New Haven drug kingpin Frank Parisi, who was going away on a weapons charge. When Parisi asked Scott to take a larger role in his business, Scott refused, a decision that would alter the course of his and Stephon's lives forever. On October 11, 1990, former New Haven, Connecticut alderman Ricardo Turner and his lover, Lamont Fields, were shot and killed while they lay in bed. Now, meet Detective Vincent Rauschke, a detective involved in Parisi's drug game who would pin this double homicide on Scott Lewis for Parisi. Rauschke put pressure on Stephon to extract the false confession that Stephon would recant the very next day. His refusal to participate in Scott Lewis's wrongful conviction would seal him to the same fate. So now we have a double homicide, politicians and law enforcement entangled in the drug game of a local mafioso kingpin, Frank Parisi. But eventually, the FBI and a whole bunch of Yale and Columbia law students under Professor Brett Dignam save the day, bringing down the entire house of cards and setting Stephon and Scott free after they had served over 20 years in prison for crimes that they did not commit. This is Wrongful Conviction. Welcome back to Wrongful Conviction. Fasten your seatbelts and listen up, because the story of Stephon Morant includes a tangled web of a drug gang, a politician who turned up dead with his male lover in his bed, a corrupt detective who was in on the drug dealing as well, and who ended up framing you, Stephon, not to mention a false confession, an incentivized witness who we know now was mentally ill and who lied through his teeth and changed his story multiple times, a mafia kingpin, in case all that other stuff wasn't enough for you, and finally, a good judge who ironically was named Hate. I mean, you can't even make this stuff up. And our featured guest today is Stephon Morant, who lived through this nightmare. So, Stephon, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
So let's go back to the beginning. I mean, this is a Connecticut story. And the facts are that on October 11th, 1990, former New Haven alderman named Ricardo Turner and his lover, Lamont Fields, were shot and killed in their bed. And that's where our story starts. So back in 1990, you were a kid. You were 21?
Yes.
Yeah. And you were, you know, you were hustling, right?
Yes.
But you weren't killing anybody.
Absolutely not.
And you certainly weren't killing Ricardo Turner and Lamont Fields.
No, I did not.
Okay. So how does this start? Because you ended up getting into the crosshairs of a, let's say, corrupt detective. I mean, corrupt would be too light of a word for this guy, Rauschke. I mean, you weren't his only victim. There were tons.
Yes.
He's sort of like a character along the lines of that guy out in Brooklyn who framed so many of those people. Stephon, set the stage for us as to this crazy cast of characters in the New Haven drug market at the time that this double murder went down, because this was the culmination of a lot of other factors. So can you give us an overview?
There's a lot of different, what you may call, I guess, organizations, guys selling on different blocks. I was working with Scott, and he was getting drugs from this guy by the name of Frank Parisi from out of the Fairhaven Heights area. That's who Detective Rauschke used to work for. I think the reason why me and Scott got framed is because Frank was about to go to prison. I think he was sentenced to 18 years, so he wanted somebody to take over the organization. And he picked Scott to take over the organization, and Scott wanted to get out of the drug trade. So Scott said that he would not do it. And next thing you know, me and Scott are being framed for murder.
So how did this cross your consciousness? When did you first become entangled in it?
As a young man, I was living with my mother at the time. I happened to call my mother in between 7:30 and 8 o'clock. Me and a couple other guys, where we were going to go to a strip club. So I just was calling her, not to tell her I was going to a strip club, but to just,
you know. Mom, I'm going to a strip club. Just right. Letting you know.
Yeah, no, we're not doing that. Yeah. So she tells me that someone came by. It was a detective, a couple of them. So she said they wanted me to call. So I was like, I have no problem with calling them. So she gave me the number. Happened to be Detective Rauschke. And I think it was a Detective Sweeney at the time, which came in the case later on. And just probably why the reason why I'm sent before you today because of Detective Sweeney. That's another part of the story. But so I happened to call him. He's asking me, could I meet him somewhere? And I said, not a problem. So my co-defendant, Mr. Lewis, and I, and another gentleman, we jumped into a vehicle. He dropped me off at a local gas station around the corner from my mother's home. And he started asking me questions. I was hesitant about answering anything because I didn't know what was going on. He opened the back door and he thrusted me in. That was the beginning of a nightmare of my life. They took me to the New Haven Police Precinct, took me to the detective bureau, held me there for hours at a time, brought out police reports, statements, newspaper articles, and started asking me questions about, do I know anything about a double homicide? I said I did not.
Had you even heard about it in the neighborhood or anything?
No, I did not.
So this is taking you totally off guard, and you didn't have a lawyer?
No, I did not.
Did they read you your rights? No, because you weren't a suspect yet.
I wasn't a suspect. Like I said, we were at the house drinking and smoking. So we was a little nice, you know, before going to the strip club. Instead of spending all the money in the strip club, we used to get high before. So we're in the police precinct for hours at a time. They start threatening me with talking about, oh, you could get the death penalty. We'll put you on $1 million bond. So I'm looking around like in a room such as this one, small little room. You know, how do I get out of here? Like, if you help us, we'll help you. We don't want you anyway. We want Lewis, so.
And Lewis was Scott Lewis.
Correct.
Scott Lewis was your friend.
My brother.
Your brother, not.
From another mother.
Your mother from another. Okay, so. And he had not been picked up yet?
No, he wasn't.
Right. So you're in there by yourself.
Correct.
Obviously, a scary situation going on. And plus, you were already a little impaired in the first place. That couldn't have helped. Although, I imagine this would kill your buzz real quick.
Yes.
But still, you didn't have all your wits about you. I mean, listen, I would like to go back in time to that day and shake you by the collar and go, dude, call a lawyer. Like, tell him you want a lawyer. That's all you had to do. And the questioning would have had to stop. But you didn't know that because most people don't know. That was one of the reasons why we do the show, because we want to tell people what to do if they, God forbid, end up in a situation like yours. So this questioning goes on and on and on. You don't even know. You probably have no sense of time at this point. Did you have a watch or anything?
No, I was. We probably got there. Like I said, it was like 8. I didn't get out of there until like probably like 5-6 hours later after they gave me all this information. They was recording me, of course, and it kept stopping the tape. That's not how we want it. We need you to write the statement correctly. Stopping the tape, stopping the tape. After they fed me all this information. So I said, I felt in my best interest, the only way I'm going to get out of here is to do what they want me to do. Because the key thing for me was what they said was, you, after you write this, you got to come back. So now I see a way out. I didn't see a way out before because they wasn't giving me a way out. I was like, listen, I don't know anything about the crime. I need to leave here. Let me go. And they was not letting me go.
Which is actually against the law as well. They had to let you go if you asked to be let go.
Right.
Like, I mean, considering they were willing to break so many other rules, they certainly weren't going to abide by that one either.
Right.
So you give a statement.
Yes.
Which is a statement that they had basically fed you.
Correct.
Giving details of the crime that you had no idea about.
Correct.
But that were accurate, presumably, if they fed them to you.
Yes.
And then, of course, stopping and starting the tape. I mean, that's right out of a TV show as well. An amateur scriptwriter would put that in there, you know. And so they end up getting what they want. Did they then arrest you or did they send you home?
No, they actually let me go.
That's crazy, too.
They told me to come back because I had to sign a statement. So my godmother, her name is Emma Jones. She was a lawyer at the time. And I immediately went to her home. When I got there, it was like 3-4 in the morning. She looked at me and I looked at her and I told her where I was coming from. And she said, you did not say anything, right? And I just put my head down. And she said, first thing in the morning, we're going to get representation. And my cousin, Detective Pontu, was my father's first cousin. He called my mother, and he knew, because at the time of the crime, when it actually happened, I wasn't even living here. I was living in South Carolina, actually going back and forth from South Carolina to North Carolina. So he was aware that I didn't live here at the time. So he called my mother. I didn't know what recant meant. So he's like, you have a statement down here. Tell Stefan, come down here, recant the statement. We know that he wasn't here. He know he wasn't here. So I went back to the detective place with my mother. A detective came out and he brought the statement out for me to sign it. I heard over the dispatch because I actually was supposed to meet my cousin over there, which was Detective Pontu. And it was like, disregard, we got this. So the detective came out. He's like, you have to sign this. I said, I'm not signing anything. I said, that's bullshit. I'm not signing it. I'm not signing it because it's a lie. It's false information. It's not true. He's like, well, if you don't sign this, we're going to charge you a conspiracy. And me and my mother just, she grabbed a pocketbook and we walked out the door.
Okay. So this is a bizarre story on a number of levels. One is that they let you go in the first place instead of making you sign a statement right after you had falsely confessed.
Right.
That's, I've never heard that one before. There must have been some reason for it, but I don't know what it was. By now, this is the next day.
Talking about going back to the police station?
Yeah.
It was a couple of days later.
Now, by now, you knew the details of the crime. You knew this was a double murder. You know it was a super serious situation.
Right.
Probably getting extra attention because of the fact that one of the dead guys, Ricardo Turner, was a former alderman, right?
Right.
So there was probably pressure to solve this crime. So now in these 3 days that had passed, did you touch base with Scott Lewis? Did you let him know what was going on?
Yes. I called him actually probably the next day and I told him about it. So he actually called the police precinct and called the detective himself and went down there and spoke to him. I don't know what the details of the conversation were, but he went down there himself.
So what happens next? How does it progress from here to where you end up getting convicted and serving almost half your life in prison?
So what was I doing prior to being convicted?
Mm-hmm.
So I, after leaving the police precinct, I went on with my life. I was working. I was working at a pizza place being a delivery guy. And the Detective Rachi, he's like, used to follow me everywhere. I moved back and forth, you know, from North Carolina, South Carolina. I moved back down there with me and my kid's mother. I formally got arrested 2 years later. So this is 1990 when the crime happened. I got arrested in February 1992. My kid's mother, Christy Sobin, she was pregnant with my sons. And we were actually living in Fayetteville, North Carolina. Her mother and father came to pick her up in December of 1991. She was complaining because I was, of course, still in the drug trade. I was going back and forth from North Carolina, South Carolina, trying to make ends meet, selling a little bit of drugs. So I call her in 1992. It happened to be February, right? My sons was born on Valentine's Day. Twins.
That's nice.
One of the greatest days of my life, of course. It was definitely a blessing. I'm like, I got to get back to Connecticut, right? Didn't have no warrant. Didn't have no nothing. The last time I heard from this detective is when I seen him follow me around in the pizza place and other various places like nightclubs and stuff like that. So I didn't see him anymore. Because I went back down south. So when I get here, I'm at my mother's home. She lives in New Haven. I happen to see a K car, you know, police detective car. I just know, you know what a detective car looks like. So I seen them and I just went the opposite way. So I happened to park my car in the commuter lot in Derby, Connecticut. And me and my friend, his name is Rob. After seeing my boys, I was on my way going back to South Carolina. So I was going to pick my car up at the commuter lot, and I seen my left tire was flat. It looked crazy. I just felt something. And then I seen a guy like in a Seville with a newspaper up on his face. Like, nobody reads a newspaper like that. Something's not right. So anyway, I get out of the car, and as soon as I get out of the car, police come from everywhere. It's like the scene out of a movie. My sons was in the back. My man was in the back. I was in the front. I got out. The detectives, I was like, they asked me, what was my name? I said, of course, my name is Stafford Moran. But I said, you guys, I got kids in the car. Could you put your guns down? It was like I was in control of the situation, but I wasn't. Because they put their guns down. I told them my name. And they were like, oh, you have an arrest warrant for double homicide. I'm like, what? Now I'm arrested for a double homicide. Like, I believe if I would have never came back to Connecticut, because what they was doing, they was about to take Scott to trial. So what they did was arrest me so they could put pressure on me so I could come and testify against Mr. Lewis. And that's just not how you say they try to put division between the both of us. And it didn't work. We both ended up, of course, getting convicted. I never testified on them because I'm not testifying to a lie. But I ended up getting arrested that day. Detective Rachi was the detective that came, him and another detective, and picked me up from the Orange Precinct. I said, here come this bull crap again. So he's like, oh, all we want you to do is tell us that Mr. Lewis committed this crime. You could go home. This warrant could go away. I'm like, listen, man, what's my bond? I just need to know my bond. That's all I want to know. Ended up giving my phone call. I called my mother. She wasn't home, so I called my aunt, told my aunt about it, and she called my mother, let her know. And I was in jail for like a few months. And then my mother, she bonded me out. She put a home up, and I stayed out for an additional 2 years. And then I went to trial in 1994.
The whole thing is really surreal. I mean, for a lot of reasons, but also because of, in particular, because of the elapsed time, right? Because I feel like listening to you talk about it now, it seems like it was kind of in the taillights. You were going on with your life, you're raising your family, trying to make ends meet, doing whatever you can, a little of this, a little legitimate stuff, some other stuff, but you weren't killing anybody, you weren't even hurting anybody. They had another sort of nefarious weapon in their arsenal, which was this, and another name that could only come out of a fictional account, right? This guy, Ovil Ruiz. Like, Ovil. Are you kidding me with this name? Not Orville, Ovil.
Yeah.
Like evil. And Ovil Ruiz gave, well, let's call it a coerced eyewitness account. He was incentivized. He was coerced. They were using a carrot and a stick. He was promised leniency. And according to Ruiz, he came up with this story. I imagine the first time you heard about this was at trial. Did you know this Ruiz guy?
Yes, I knew of him. Well, when we sold drugs, he used to sell drugs, yes. We wasn't the best of friends, but I know who he was.
So Ruiz came up with a pretty interesting story. He said that this alderman, the former alderman, Ricardo Turner, was storing drugs and money for Lewis, your co-defendant, for his operation in the second floor apartment that he lived in, and that he also owed Lewis money. So according to Ovil Ruiz, I love saying that name over and over again. On October 10th and 11th of 1990, he claimed that you and Lewis discussed the idea that Turner might take the money and run. And therefore, Ruiz rode with you guys to Turner's apartment and waited in the car while you, again, this is his account, his false account, but his account, he claimed that armed with a .357 and a .38, that you guys forced your way into Turner's apartment, murdered he and Fields in their bed, then took the money and the coke, got in the getaway car. Now, this would all be a little bit more believable if not for the fact that he was promised leniency if he admitted to being the getaway driver. And, you know, he probably didn't even come up with this story. They probably came up with it and gave it to him. But whatever.
Well, you know, at the time of me going to trial, this young kid had a background in mental health issues. My lawyer at the time subpoenaed his records, and this guy was talking about he see red bean. He see different visions. He's on Haldol and various drugs for his mental health. So he was not only thrown and thrusted in and given leniency for giving false testimony, but he also was a mental health patient. You know, I don't even understand how the jury believed this guy.
So now they had you guys. They had this guy. They had a false confession. You had no shot at trial.
Absolutely not.
So you go to trial, you were tried separately from Lewis.
Yes. I have four counts. First, I have five counts. One count of conspiracy, they dropped that at the beginning of the trial. Two counts of aiding to abetting, and two counts of felony murder.
So when the jury came back in, did you have any hope that they would come to the right answer? You still believed?
Yes.
Even after everything that happened, you still believed that justice was going to win out?
Of course, I did have hope because I didn't do it.
So, okay, so take us to that moment. So the jury comes in and they read the charges in order.
Right.
Right? So you've already had the one charge dropped. Now you have the first two charges and they go not guilty.
Right.
So after that second not guilty,
I'm late.
You're like, I'm going home.
Yes.
I mean, and then they drop a bomb on you.
And then
a literal bomb.
And I almost fell over. Literally, I rocked back. I had to catch myself. And then I looked at the jury person. And he shook his head like, yeah, we convicting you. And then he read it off again. I looked in his eyes again. And then he put his head down. The prosecutor, he was just as corrupt as the detective in my eyes. My sons, again, they was twins. They were 2 years old at the time. And I didn't see my sons in a while, you know? So they bring me to court. I didn't even know I was going to court. The prosecutor buys a fruit basket. He puts it on the table. So my mother's there. I didn't know my mother was going to be there. And my sons are there. So he says to me, you missed this? of course. I mean, what kind of question is that? Of course I miss my kids. He said, so what you gonna do about it? I said, listen, I told you before, I don't know nothing about this. I'm not, the same way I'm looking at my sons right here, Mr. Lewis has kids as well. So I'm gonna just take myself and say, okay, I'm gonna lie on the man to take myself out of prison to put him in prison possibly. I can't do that. I just can't do that.
Did he actually tell you that he was willing to give you a deal if you would testify against Lewis, or you just assumed that?
That's what he told me.
And what was the deal they offered you?
He said we would work it out. He didn't tell me, well, I'm going to take 35. I got 70 years now. 35 years running wild, which means do this 35 years and start all over again. So what can you offer me? You can't offer me nothing. He couldn't offer me a day, because I'm not going to sit here and lie on a man for something that I didn't do and he didn't do. It's just not going to happen.
And that speaks to your character, too, because I think there's, you know, no one knows how anyone would deal with a situation like the one that you were in, but you handled it, I mean, with courage and, you know, you did the right thing at extreme cost to yourself. So now you're sentenced to 70 years and you get taken to prison. I mean, how did you get out? I mean, these are the things I want to get to here, because you were there for 20 years?
21.
21 years in maximum security. Obviously, it's felony murder.
Yes. I believe that my guy made a way. You know, I mean, of course, legal things took place, but people came back. Like I mentioned to you earlier, Detective Sweeney, he was a great part in this case. He came back after he was in Bosnia in 1998, 1999. He happened to see my case. I was going back for a petition for new trial. And I had a lawyer by the name of Michael Fitzpatrick at the time. And he said, I got some good evidence that's coming. And it took another 1999 to 2015, 16 more years for the court to even listen to him. And this was a supervisor of Detective Rachi that's telling you that the two men that you have in prison, if you're going by the information that was gathered by Detective Rachi and that informant that you had that testified on these guys, absolutely not.
That was Sweeney was saying.
Detective Sweeney. He came to testify to that.
That's so crazy. I'm getting the chills now thinking about it, because here you have a senior official in law enforcement who is coming forward with no motivation. What could his motivation possibly be other than the truth? And they're going, nah, we're good. Like, yeah. I mean, he's one of the heroes in this story, right?
Without a doubt.
Scott Lewis wrote a letter to the FBI as well about Rachi. They looked into it. And every time they did, they would find that things were not as he said they were, but as you guys said they were. They found that Rachi not only framed you and Lewis, but that he framed a number of other people. I don't think we'll ever know how many, because we know when these guys do it, like Scarcella in Brooklyn, they just keep doing it and doing it and doing it as long as they get away with it, which is why it's so important that we tell these stories. And they even brought him back, Rachi. They brought [S2] Yes. [S1] Him back to New Haven to question him. But they never charged him. They ended up charging him, which is ridiculous, but they charged him for misbilling his overtime hours and assaulting his wife, which is a serious crime in my view, and yet he received 2 years probation. So he was dealing drugs, framing people for murder, assaulting his wife, and he gets 2 years probation, and you end up with 70 years for a crime you didn't commit. Another hero in this story. And it's interesting because it's a New Haven story. And along comes a Yale law professor named Brett Dignam and Richard Emanuel and a whole bunch of law students, right? Coming in like the cavalry.
Yes.
All from Yale.
Yes.
And that's a pretty good group to have on your side, because at Yale, they don't mess around. There's no question that you have an incredible amount of brain power and energy devoted to your case. How did they get involved? How did they find out about it?
They got involved in Scott's case, actually. 2009, and Brett moved from, she was a law professor at Yale, and then she moved to Columbia, and then a lot of the students just went along with her, or she just had some more Columbia students. I'm not really sure of the whole procedure, how it went down, but they played a big role in this, getting the conviction overturned.
And finally, a good judge, who ironically was named Haight.
The judge Haight, huh? What a name, but a loving guy.
Yeah, Judge Charles Haight, the U.S. District Judge, Charles Haight Jr. Your team won a ruling in front of Judge Haight that the prosecution had failed to tell the defense, and this is heavy, get ready, that the key witness, Oval Ruiz, had repeatedly denied having any knowledge of the murders. all of a sudden he had a big memory recall after he was offered a deal. But it's important to recognize that he was at least initially telling the truth. Doesn't excuse his behavior whatsoever, but it does highlight the lengths that they were willing to go to get a conviction. And let us not forget that, of course, in your case, like in so many other wrongful conviction cases, whoever it was that went and cold-bloodedly gunned these two guys down, whether it was one guy, two guys, a woman, we don't know who it was, right? I don't know if you to this day know who it was.
No, I don't know who it is. Right. I mean, they have other suspects that they say they have, but I don't know if they push forward to try to arrest anybody. I mean, I don't wish nothing bad on anybody, but whether it's one individual, two or three individuals still out there. So now what about our public?
Exactly. Let's just say it's not unlikely that whoever it was that committed this crime went on to commit other terrible crimes while you guys were serving the time for them. So how did you end up getting out, and why? I'm sure people are listening at home in their cars, whatever, saying to themselves, but wait a minute. So you had this whole dream team, all of a sudden the Avengers riding in from Yale. How is it that you were never fully exonerated? How did that work? And was that because of your false confession? Is that why they refused to ultimately admit your innocence?
Actually, Mr. Lewis, he was released in February, March of 2014 on a bracelet. Judge Haight ordered that they release him within 90 days, I think, of after the conviction was overturned in December. Well, actually, after they affirmed it. It got overturned, then it had to go to the Second Circuit Court, and then all the charges was dropped. I think he got exonerated in 2016, if I'm not mistaken. But it went in sequence. Like, 1 year he got out, the next year it was affirmed. Next year, I think he got exonerated. Unlike myself, Mr. Lewis had a dream team, and I had a team that wasn't fighting for me at all. So push forward to a year later, after they affirmed for Mr. Lewis, I was released because the attorney said he spoke with the district attorney and said, oh, I think that I could talk to him. So talk to him about what? Like, why now you not filing the motion for me to get out of prison? Because you and Mr. Lewis' case is different. I said, what you mean? What do you mean different? We just went to trial differently. The evidence is the same. We just went to trial at different times. I want to be released from prison. I said, how long more do you think this is going to take? He said, it might take another 3 years. What? This man's out of prison. You telling me I still got to wait an additional 3 years to be released from prison? He was like, yeah. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to go talk, because I'm friends with the district attorney. So I'm going to go down there and see if he'll just say, see what could happen. I think that was a Tuesday. So he came back the very next day. He's like, oh, I got good news from you. You're going home. The district attorney said, we'll give you time served, but you have to cop out. I'm thinking now. My little brother, he just passed away, lupus. I lost my grandfather. I lost my father. I lost a host of a lot of friends. My mother's getting older. My children are older. You know, they, dad, when are you coming home? I have a wife now that married me for I don't know why in prison in 2009. What do I do? I'm between a rock and a hard place. Do I sit here and say, listen, I'm going to fight for my name to be clear for another 3 years? There's nothing guaranteed in the judicial system. They already failed me once. So what do I do? I've always heard that if you can fight better from the outside than the inside. I need to get out. I need to get out of here. So I went with the terms and the agreement. I mean, ignorant, of course, of the repercussions of still fighting for my conviction, because I still have a conviction. Mr. Lewis, as I told you a couple minutes ago, is exonerated. Same evidence, just different trial. He's exonerated. I'm struggling. I just had to get a second job. You know, what do? You know, I got to survive, though, you know.
Yeah, I hope that this show maybe can be a part of helping you to get the justice that you have deserved for a quarter of a century now, ever since you were wrongfully arrested in the first place, over a quarter of a century, almost 30 years, and that you can get a chance to get the compensation that you deserve, and that your co-defendant has received a significant amount of compensation. A lot of guys never get it, you know, a lot of guys and women, even whether they took a plea or whether they were exonerated. And people ask me all the time, and we still only have like 32 states that have compensation statutes, and we're trying to change that, because I think that everyone who's wrongfully convicted deserves compensation and deserves help to get back on their feet, as opposed to putting more roadblocks in your way, like they're doing with you, which I call the second punishment.
I'm out here and I'm thankful. I'm thankful that I'm able to be able to stand on my two feet. I'm able to go to a job and to go and make a difference. I don't know if you know, but I work at a halfway house. You know, it's a part of the correctional facility. Like, my grandmother was a caregiver, so I guess I'm following the footsteps of her. I also just took on another job working with the mental health. I work at Hartford Healthcare now. It's not a lot of money, but it's getting me and my wife by, because at the end of the day, I mean, it's a struggle. Again, Mr. Lewis was compensated for his wrongful conviction. I'm still fighting. I told you, I spoke with you earlier as far as me and my lawyer right now, we're trying to put together a pardon to try to see if that the state of Connecticut will pardon me. Unusual circumstances. We spoke with various people about it. So hopefully that this doesn't take forever, that my conviction is overturned so I can go on and live my life. Because I can't get jobs that pays well because I have a conviction on my record. You know, I'm actually like getting half the pay, you know, for something that I didn't do and I'm still suffering. Sometimes I'd be like, yo, why? But then at the end of the day, why not? I'm not the first person that it happened to and won't be the last person that it happens to.
One of the reasons I do this work and I'm so obsessed and committed to it, have been for my whole adult life and will be for the rest of my adult life, however long that may be, is because of people like you. I'm honestly in awe that people like yourself can go through what you went through and come out with this. And I picked it up when we met before. Is one of the reasons I want to have you on the show, because you're such a positive guy and you're such a sort of, I mean, to meet you, no one would ever know that you had been through anything like this, much less this totally insane ordeal. So how did you survive prison? Was it as bad as what you were expecting? Was it as bad as what people think it is?
Well, for me, I have a Christian background, right? My grandmother was a faith-driven woman. My mother, you know, my father used to take me to church all the time. Actually, the day I got convicted, June 8th, that night, when they threw me, told me, they remanded me, I was like a whole building on top of me. Like, and I didn't know how I was gonna get it off of me. So they put me in a bullpen, there was nobody down there, and I'm looking around, like, and I had a suit on, and a tie, so I shifted my tie from the left to the right, and I'm like, yo, how did I get here? How did this happen to me? So I was about to cry, of course. I'm like, and so literally a voice came over me and said, son, you gonna be all right. You know, I got down on my knees in that bullpen and I prayed. And that was my peace. That was my sanctuary. That was my sanity. That's what brought me through. Just not my faith alone, but my family was there for me and they're still there for me. My big brother, Frank, my brother, Julian, he passed away at lupus a year before I came home. He was my greatest support. My brother, Leander, my mother, Linda. Or a host of family and friends. I mean, you know, it's crazy in prison because some people don't even know what the visiting room looked like. I just had a great support. My wife, rain, sleet, or snow. I'm telling you, if it was 6 feet of snow and the roses clear, she was there. You know, and that says a lot for her. You know, but again, I had a lot of family there for me. My family was there. They're still there for me. And again, my faith kept me whole. You know, I actually go to school right now to a Bible Institute to become a minister. It's not easy. I go through a lot of ups and downs because of the incarceration. I call it today because of they thrust me into a cage. I'm that dog that's running away from the cage, never to go back to that cage again. I want to go back there, but I want to go back there for the right reasons. As far as if I could inspire or encourage somebody to be like, listen, there is hope. There's guys that see me today when I was actually incarcerated. Well, I don't call it incarcerated again. When I was thrust into that cage, they just literally like start crying. Like, Yo, you believed. Like, you believed you was coming home or you was going home and you're here. Sometimes, of course, it gets rough sometimes, you know? But what do you do with a situation when it happens to you? Do you sit down, weep, and cry, or do you get up and stand tall? Because that's what they want you to do. They want you to be like, okay, we're going to take this person, thrust them in a cage, and we want them to become an animal. I did the total opposite. I became an example. like to be a better person than what they wanted me to be. Even through incarceration, I was counseling people, whether it was COs, whether it was convicts, whether it was inmates. I just had a calling, and I'm still doing that to this day. So I'm just not say grateful for incarceration. Absolutely not. But I'm grateful now for the opportunity to give back and to share with others that I've been through what you've been through. Like I talk to the guys in the halfway house all the time. Listen, I'm not gonna sit down and tell you that I've been in prison for 21 years, but I'm gonna let you know I've been where you are. You could change, you can transition. Your life could be totally different than what it really is today, but you have to make that first step. I could only give you a little bit of tools and ingredients, something that I could share with you, a word of advice, but I can't make you walk. Like they say, you could bring a horse to the trough, but you can't make him drink.
Stefan, if people want to reach out to you, do you do public speaking?
Yes, I do.
And how do if people want to get involved in your case in any way, how do they reach out to you?
Through Gmail, Stefan Morant, StefonMorant at gmail.com.
Stefan Morant, StefonMorant at gmail.com. And the movie about this crazy case is called 120 Years.
If you haven't watched it yet, I think you could go on YouTube and watch it, but it's called 120 Years, a documentary of Scott Lewis. I'm also a part of that as well.
Check it out. So now we get to my favorite part of the show where I, first of all, I thank you again, Stefan Morant, for coming to the studio and sharing your thoughts and your incredible story, and wish you all the best for the future. And then I get to turn off my microphone and just sit back and leave yours on for what we've come to call closing arguments. Go for it.
Well, I just like to say I appreciate and I thank you for everything that you do. Wrongful conviction is just, it's a sad day. It's just a sad situation. I remember my first Innocence Project conference, and they say you go and you network. It was in Texas. So I was just walking about and I seen this guy and I just walked up to him, and he was a social worker from out of Ohio. Hey, how you doing? He says, oh, I'm all right. How are you? I said, yeah. He said, we need to network, meet different people. So he said, what happened with you? And I said, well, I was unjustly incarcerated for 21 years out of New Haven, Connecticut. And I said to him, I said, yeah, everybody says that they're innocent. And he looked at me and he says, no, they don't. And I had to think about that. And I said, wow, you're actually right. You hear that on TV, but in prison, it's like I could count on probably one of my hands that somebody actually said that they were innocent. And I've been around thousands and thousands of guys. If somebody tell you they're innocent, right, how much effort does it take for you just to reopen an investigation or to just look into what he or she is saying, instead of allowing this to carry on for like it carried on with me and Mr. Lewis, for Mr. Lewis 20 years and for myself 21 years, crying, like getting shot down, denials after denials after denials. You know, again, now I have 7 kids, Christian and Julian, Matwile and Stefan Jr., Jayla, Mia, and Prince Boy Jr. So we have, me and my wife have a total of 7 kids. Her name is Kimberly Morant. You know, 4 biological, but all of them are biological to me now because that's how I bring my acceptance. You know, my children today, I don't even have a relationship like with them. I mean, we're building one, and that's like the saddest part of this situation. But at the end of the day, it's like, how do you just do that to somebody, and how do you live with yourself, right? We need to change the way the judicial system is being ran. Today, you know, it has to be changed. We just need somebody just to have an ear and to listen, not just to say, well, we're going to talk about doing something, don't do something. If you just put forth an effort and take the time out of your day, just be like, okay, just let me look into this case. Give me an opportunity. Give me a chance. The evidence is going to speak for itself. It's just as simple as that. If the person actually committed the crime, you could set time for saying they did this or they didn't do it. But just give them an opportunity. Reinvestigate the situation. You know, I mean, I thank God for the FBI. You know, who does that? They don't just say, okay, you write me a letter and now I'm going to get involved. And they say, hold up, something wrong is going on. And then the state's attorney still doesn't do anything about it. The state's attorney stated that for a period of time, we knew that the lead detective was a liar, also the key witness. So why am I sitting here taking time served? Why are you just not saying, okay, we're dismissing this case right now? So if it's a lie, if it's a tainted situation, why on earth is Stephon Morant still a convicted felon? Mind you, I've never had a traffic ticket. I've never had a conviction. I sold a little drugs to get by, but I worked all my life. The question is, and I leave with this, I need help. And I need Stephon Morant's conviction to be overturned because it's just not right. If one is innocent, the other one definitely has to be innocent because you're saying I was just there. You didn't say I'd kill anybody. So how am I still a convicted felon?
Don't forget to give us a fantastic review wherever you get your podcasts. It really helps. And I'm a proud donor to the Innocence Project, and I really hope you'll join me in supporting this very important cause and helping to prevent future wrongful convictions. Go to innocenceproject.org to learn how to donate and get involved. I'd like to thank our production team, Connor Hall and Kevin Wardis. The music in the show is by 3-time Oscar-nominated composer Jay Ralph. Be sure to follow us on Instagram at Wrongful Conviction and on Facebook at Wrongful Conviction Podcast. Wrongful Conviction with Jason Flom is a production of Lava for Good Podcasts in association with Signal Company No. 1.